Welcome to Generous Impact. This is Brett Brummett.
And this is Amanda Brummett. We are joined today by Lisa Marshall, founder and CEO of Fighting Homelessness. In this episode, you'll hear how they are dedicated to identifying and addressing the root causes of chronic homelessness. Well, Lisa, thank you so much for being here today. We really appreciate it. And we really appreciate our great friend, Amy Goddard, for making that introduction. Lisa, can you tell us about your background? Who are you personally and professionally?
Yes, thank you so much for having me today. And I am married to my husband, Frank, and I have been married for 30 years. And we have three amazing sons, Zachary, Cooper, and Joshua. I have a degree in criminal justice with a minor in sociology. And right out of college, I worked for Hershey's Chocolate for 10 years. And then retired in 2000, I obtained my yoga certification and opened a yoga studio in Coppell for a little over 10 years and then sold it in 2012. But I've continued teaching for over 22 years.
Such a good combination, criminal justice, sociology, corporate America, and then yoga.
Lots of hats. And mom, yeah. Don't forget that one.
Right. Lots that one's huge. Three boys.
Yes, it was busy, a busy time.
Yeah, and going back through like your career, your time, you spent a long time volunteering and doing a lot of community work before launching Fighting Homelessness. What prompted you to take all of that investment and move it into a structured nonprofit instead of just giving your time to other organizations?
Well, I kind of felt, I think, that a lot of the passion that I had was stopped in some of those organizations. And there might have been legal reasons for not being able to communicate or do the things that I wanted to do in those spaces. And I knew I wanted to do more. And so I think that, I went from seeing people that I wanted to help and donate my time with, and then really feel what they were going through. And I honestly did not know what hopelessness actually felt like. And when I really saw the depths of people not having any hope, I didn't know that was a thing. and then just understanding that it was going to take way more than just, a few hours passing out food here and there. I mean, they needed legislation. They needed someone to help walk alongside so their stories could really be heard. And that's the difference in, the level of what it takes to get things changed and to help people be able to move forward and have hope again.
And were you, how long did that need to go beyond the other organizations you're working with or see their initiatives not go the same direction? How long did that resonate with you before you had the gumption or the leadership prompt to move on?
Probably about a year, I would say. I spent 2018 to 2019, just doing volunteer work at a senior for 55 and older, chronically homeless seniors. And it was then when I met a couple of the gentlemen there that had issues with their back child support. And I remember meeting Kevin and Kevin explaining to me that he needed a job underneath the table. And I didn't even know what underneath the table actually meant. And then he explained that, well, he couldn't work because half his paycheck was, taken by the state. And I said, well, that can't happen. But yes, it actually can happen. And, when I started digging into it and realizing that he was one of many that are in this situation. And I knew that at that point, bigger mountains needed to be moved and more people needed to be informed and educated of how can we change this mass problem.
Yeah. So let's get into those bigger mountains and the details around them. You've got this monumental task of reducing, or let's say even eliminating, homelessness at some point. And it seems like your organization works at both a macro and a micro level to help the people that are suffering with it right now, but also to change it. So can you walk us through that?
Sure. I guess more on a micro level, we do. I start with working with men while they're incarcerated. So I do a prison ministry on Mondays at Hutchins State Prison, and just kind of learning what they're facing before they ever even come out of incarceration. And then after that, we work with what can they do to stay out of recidivism. You know, the law is really stacked against them. There's not a lot of options out there. And so, you know, we look at how we can get them to the next step so that maybe they can get housing and they can get their identification and they can get in a reentry program and things like that. But on a much broader, that's when we take our feet to legislation. And we had a bill in 2023 trying to give men and women a forbearance, a 6 months forbearance once they are released, so that they can get their all the identification and everything they need, employment, housing, so that they can participate in their child's life. If they don't, if they're unable to do that, then that's why they recidivate and they go back to prison. And it's just a very harsh, old, outdated legislation that's keeping them into this situation. So we work on both. We work on, you know, everything from the mental side of this. I mean, I've been on the phone at nighttime with men literally living in the back of a U-Haul truck because there was nowhere for them to live, and having $50,000 in child support, and just, you know, just grateful that someone is there to listen to their problems and tell them that, you know, I know there's a law that's keeping you from this, but here are some angles that we can do. Let's see what we can do to at least get you out of the U-Haul and maybe into some type of housing.
That is such a good perspective, Lisa, because I knew a lot about, you know, people coming out of incarceration and how they're just really set up to fail and it's terrible. I'd never even thought about the back child support, which obviously I think we can all agree people should pay child support on their children, you know, logical. Absolutely. But give them a minute to get their life back on track beforehand. And so I appreciate that you're getting into that granular level of causes like that are helping or that are harming them from being able to resume a normal life and a job and a relationship with their kids. And so thank you for that perspective. I learned something today.
Yes, welcome.
And how long working with it did you decide that you needed to go back to the upstream area and start engaging while people are coming out of incarceration? Or what other upstream areas have you seen that you've wanted to tackle or currently do tackle?
Well, so you can look at it as two ways. One way that we tackle it is trying to educate. And I met with a director, an Emmy and Peabody director, Thaddeus Matula, and started working on a documentary to spread awareness and to let people know, because I don't think anybody really understands the child support system. I mean, we think about deadbeat dads not paying, avoiding their responsibilities, but that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about dead broke dads who were incarcerated and their orders never stopped. So they never had the means to pay while they were incarcerated. And the interest that tagged onto that. So in Texas, it used to be 12%. It has dropped to 6%. I know there's a senator that's proposing, hopefully this 25 session, to even lower that even more. But, you know, it's crazy that we have $18 billion in child support arrears in the state of Texas. and what that does to all of us, all the taxpayers, the family, the second generation, is keeping us all in debt and all the systems that are being taxed because of it. So, you know, if you can educate, that was my, you know, first desire, is to let everyone know how broken the system was. And then let's see if that could work towards legislation. We ended up taking about 60 hours and editing it down to 8 minutes. And on my white paper that I pushed around, you know, state capitol had 8 minutes of the problem and solutions that we could, you know, hopefully change, because it is a federal law, but states do have certain rights. And the way we handle our child support is, you know, based on Texas's state desires. And we don't do a very good job. We really don't care about this. And we're more into just keeping these people down. We shouldn't be the only state in the union that has 1 billion cases. I mean, that's crazy. You know, California doesn't even have that many. But then yet we only have about 2,600 full-time employees to take care of that, whereas California has 6,000 full-time employees taking care of about 700 arrears cases. So you can see that there's not really the interest in helping this situation. So education is one of the ways that I think people need to understand. And then legislation has got to change. You know, it will have to change at the federal level, but there's a lot that can be done at the state level as well.
Yeah. So I'm going to go off script, Lisa. I hope that's okay. I'm super curious. And I know we're talking about homelessness, but, you know, if we're talking about root causes and these dads, you're not talking about violent murderers that are in prison. I assume, and please correct me if I'm wrong, we're talking about low-level drug crimes. We're
talking about someone with 2 DWIs.
2 DWIs. Okay. So are you guys working at all on preventing the incarceration to begin with?
So we work with men coming out to give the situation that got them there, because if they can, if 2 DWIs are going to knock you off of your feet and keep you in that pattern, that's not a good thing. How can you forgive yourself, forgive the situation? You may have been, you know, a lot of it is just resources, not even having the right resources, not being underemployed or unemployed. Someone may have been a master plumber, been hurt on the job, lost his job. Now he's losing his house. They're always the last thing to go is the car. Now they're living in their car. And then the next thing you know, all that time, you know, you choose, am I going to feed myself and try to keep myself alive? Or do I pay the $675, you know, dollar child support because it has all this interest in it because I got 2 months behind? So, you know, when you're 2 months in arrears, that's when that interest starts, and it just builds and builds and builds. And so if you're in prison for 6 years for 2 DWIs and you went in maybe at 6,000, 10,000, something like that, and all that interest starts compounding, you come out, how do you get a job? Now you're a felon. How do you know, you're not making 3 times the rent to be able to rent an apartment, and you're behind, you know, and you got mom going, why aren't you paying your child support? Well, I don't have the money. You know, it's not a deadbeat. It's a completely dead broke. And then they're homeless, or they end up homeless, or they end up back in the criminal justice system. So it's just a vicious cycle, and one that affects all of us.
Yeah. Lose, lose, lose.
Yeah. Did you ever think after getting out of your studies through criminal justice, you'd be back actually working on recidivism?
No, that's funny that you asked that. I wasn't even sure if I was ever going to use my degree. Mm-hmm. You know, but boy, I do use it now. It's funny how God has such a humor, and it's not where your journey is and when all those things are going to take place. But yeah, I'm happy that I am using it now, because it's important as far as moving legislation forward and understanding, you know, the criminal justice system. When I graduated from college in 87, the textbooks weren't on rehabilitation at all. I mean, they were all on, you know, get tough on crime. Everything was bad. Just put them behind bars. Yeah.
I think we were just barely getting there in the late 90s when I went through all that. And it was, rehabilitation programs were a very new and novel concept that were studied in isolation and not in practice, I believe.
Yeah. Yes.
So with all of your work and everything you've done, what have you seen as your biggest impacts?
I think the collaboration with other agencies and other people that are already doing the work and working with them and just having good partners that, you know, I had a wonderful state rep, Rep Sherman, who carried my bill, and then all of the different reps and state senators that I met that were very pro H bill, you know, House Bill 3332. But, you know, there, we can't do it alone. No one needs to reinvent the wheel. But once you can find good partners to collaborate with, you have a bigger voice. And I think that's what really moves the needle.
In collaboration, what's that general journey of someone's understanding of homelessness, who is experiencing homelessness, and do they have a turn of attitude when you work with them, with like your legislative partners?
Not as much. So, you know, we're a very red state, and we don't, you know, social services are, they're kind of in their own special, unique lane, and finding people in that lane to work with against those who don't really want to support that effort, so to speak. You know, I think the fact that the child support agency only has 2,500 full-time employees, and we have over a million cases, kind of shows that we don't really care, and that's not our initiative to get these people back on their feet. So then it's left to people that are advocating for a change, advocating for different avenues to get these people back on their feet, you know, second chance employers. I mean, you name it, everything from all the different aspects to keep people out of homelessness. And it's a struggle every day, but more and more people are coming to the table and just finding those collaborators and not trying to reinvent the wheel. I think people just spend so much time on, you know, let's look at it this way, let's look at it that way. Why don't we look at what other states are doing? Yeah, you know, I talked the whole time that I was presenting my bill. I kept saying, look what Oklahoma and Louisiana are doing. They're two red states that are our neighbors, and they're doing better than we are, you know, but a lot of times they don't want to hear that. They don't care what Louisiana and Oklahoma are doing. You know, we followed what Mississippi, we're one step above what Mississippi's doing. So, you know, that that scares you. But, you know, just finding best practices that work and try it. You know, that's the biggest thing is, you know, be willing to be flexible and try new things.
Yeah. I think so many people, until they know someone that has experienced homelessness or know someone that's been incarcerated, they can't wrap their head around the world that you live and work in every day. It's just, it's too much to think about.
I couldn't think about it myself. Like I said, when Kevin told me he needed a job underneath the table, I'm like, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
And, you know, he's like, well, the government can't know what I'm making. I'm like, why can't they know what you're making?
Right.
You know, because they take half of it. So, you know, some of those things are just, we don't even know as a public, you know, what things are going on until you you hear them, and then they're mind boggling. And then you dig and you're like, this is right. He is exactly right.
Yeah.
Kind of crazy.
Definitely. So speaking of Kevin and your organization, one thing that I love that you shared when we were chatting about fighting homelessness is that 65% of your volunteers have been chronically homeless. They've lived the story and are now on the other side. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, I'm blessed with having people with lived experiences, and I love watching them take the lead. It's so rewarding to see them. You know, sometimes we'll go into encampments and I'll have three people with me and we'll all have fighting homelessness t-shirts on. And the people that we're mentoring to think we all are, you know, an agency with all these people that have had all this knowledge for years on how the system works. But actually, the people that know how the system works are the people with lived experiences. So to have them, you know, say, hey, you know, I used to sleep here. This is what I used to do. I know what you're going through. And they're like, oh my gosh, and you have the t-shirt. You're here today wearing a fighting homelessness t-shirt. So, you know, as soon as when we meet with people, we always encourage them to come out with us and do outreach. And most of the times that we are doing outreach, I'm dragging along people with lived experiences so that they can heal on their own, but also they can have such an impact on the people that we're working with. Same with the prison. You know, when I go into the prison, I speak in front of about 100 or 115 men. And I'm not a male that has been in prison, right? But my partner has. And so, you know, hearing him and being with him and watching the men relate to him and seeing that there is hope, that you can not only, you know, get out of here, but you can come back in here and serve and help others. I mean, that there's no better testament and beautiful life to watch and to see when others can help others and heal on their own. And that's what's been so rewarding for me, is to watch the healing that has gone on.
Yeah, that's got to be amazing just to watch, witness it. And it's a beautiful thing that you've been a part of it, but way more beautiful that it's not you carrying that message too, which is fantastic. So what is one policy or practice, and I think I may know from our conversation, that you really wish that the governmental organizations would consider changing?
Well, obviously the child support.
Yeah. That's what I was thinking.
The Bradley bill has got to go. You know, 1986 came and went. let's change that. I mean, we still don't need to be doing the things that we did back in 1986, right? So we shouldn't have $115 billion in the United States in child support arrears. That's helping nobody. And so to see that change would be, you know, so wonderful. There, even if the bill that I had proposed in 23 and the ones that I really want to propose in 25, it's not going to grandfather the men that, you know, are stuck in this situation. Legislation always happens at the end, and it's for the, you know, those moving forward, right? So then what do you do to the 445,000 cases that aren't paying a penny towards their child support? You know, I've got a gentleman who, he's in my documentary as well, and he still owes child support, and his children are in their 30s. And he has a wonderful job, and but years of, you know, living in and having horrible food sources, diet, and, you know, being homeless caused him to have a kidney failure. And he was on dialysis for about 12 years and received a kidney. And during his time when he was not able to work, his 30-year-old children paid his child support for him. He will go to his grave owing child support.
That is incredibly ridiculous. And honestly, I didn't know that it didn't stop. Like once the kids got older, they passed back through that and all that peace. It's something I've been fortunate not to experience.
Yeah.
And I think that has a whole lack of knowledge around that.
I mean, imagine knowing that you're going to owe for the rest of your life, you know, and it's crazy. It's absolutely crazy.
Okay. So Lisa, I'm hearing a lot of things that we need to fix in the system. I'm also hearing a lot of positive that you're accomplishing both at an individual level and at a governmental level. So what's next for fighting homelessness?
Well, we have a couple of big things. Right now, we're working on a housing project. We're partnering with Dallas College and CASA and North Texas Behavioral Health and Austin Street Center and others to build affordable housing for kids aging out of foster care. But we're putting a complete spin on it, and we're doing an intergenerational community. So we're going to house 14 kids aging out of foster care and 7 seniors on fixed income that would be homeless if they were unable to find housing in their income. So over the past couple of years, I've been fortunate to work with Jesuit College Prep and St. Mark's and Coppell Young Men's Service League, and they volunteer with me. And I had no idea the magic that would happen between a 17, 18, 19-year-old and a 55 and older. And there's a communication that only happens between those age groups. And it's magical to watch. And so we are putting both of those age groups together in a living community that's surrounded by supportive service. And our partners are the ones that will be providing the services and case management for the kids. And then we will case manage the 7 seniors. So that's our big thing that we're working on. We're still going to come back in 2025 with legislation, hopefully, around the child support issue. I'm also working with Texas Housers and other agencies trying to move the needle for more affordable housing and tenants' rights. And I'm always working for more housing rights out there for people with evictions and also just being able to stay in the home that they're renting or owning. But we're super excited about this new venture and just love the fact that, you know, we're fortunate that there's funding coming down, there's vouchers coming down to help these kids aging out of foster care, because it's pretty slim out there. So we are building individual homes, and that's a kind of a new thing for Dallas. There's one already in Austin, but we're hoping to be the first of many. So if this template works, then it can be replicated throughout the city and then replicated throughout the state.
As I understand, kiddos aging out of the foster system are way high risk to end up with lots of different things that negatively impact in their lives, but being incarcerated being one of them. Mm-hmm. It'd be so interesting to watch the data on those kids 5, 10, 15 years later. And I'm just going to go ahead and say it. I think we're going to see more success and more health in their life.
Oh, yes. Yes. And UTA, they're our largest partner because they're doing the actual architectural and the build. And they've done a lot of research, and they're doing research right now just to find out what type of housing these kids would want and what would help them thrive and be successful. But yes, when kids age out of foster care, 30% of them become homeless the day they age out, and 20% are incarcerated. But the biggest thing was that only 32% of them are employed. And so, yeah, I was really surprised at that. So I even attended a symposium today, and I was with a bunch of different partners and collaborators over this whole scenario of how can we educate. It really is education. It comes down to, you know, what resources are out there. Everyone wants to be in their own silo, their own lane, but let's all put that together and make it where it's it's easy for someone to maneuver through the situation and the system. Same thing happens with housing. Everyone wants to, you know, be in their own thing. Like, oh my gosh, I want all the clients to come to my organization. Well, your organization may be really good at one thing, but let's let someone else that they're really good at that, you know, also work with them, and let's partner together so that, you know, we take the best parts of our organization and we utilize those. And then now we have a system. We're not in silos.
So that tackles, you know, what I think is one of the biggest problems I see from the outside is that you don't know where to start to understand the problem, whether you're inside of it or whether you're outside wanting to help. So what are good resources for someone to have, like a quick primer on homelessness causes and where to invest in impact?
You know, I think there's such a misconception out there that people want to be homeless, that they, you know, they just choose that path. And that's so far from the truth. We know that if you look at the residents at a shelter, they say that about 10 to 15% probably do have mental illness. And we know that our jails are full of mentally ill people, right? We just don't have mental health facilities. You know, we got rid of those in the Reagan era and we just really haven't brought them back. And then the other 10 to 15%, they are just there because they had a bump in the road, right? Maybe they lost a family member, they've lost their job, they've lost their house. You know, who knows? You know, COVID was really hard on people. But then there's also that percentage in the middle, maybe 50 to 60, that they don't make enough money. You know, they're underemployed. I mean, at what is it, 8.25 or 7.25? I don't even know what our minimum wage here is in Texas, but it's way low. We know that incomes are not keeping up with the cost of living here, and there is no houses. You know, the housing shortage, it's real. It is real, real, real. You know, some people don't see it when they're in their home and they only drive to a certain part of the city. They don't see that there are other parts of the city that there are no housing. But, you know, there are many factors that play into that. It's not, oh my gosh, they just chose to do drugs and not have a job. There are systems that are keeping them from that. And so being more compassionate and be willing to say, hey, how can I get involved in helping that arm of it? So maybe you have your talents are with your job, you have access to healthcare, or you have access to a food supply, or you have access to clothing, or, you know, something like that. You know, maybe that's how you dip your foot into it. I know a lot of people aren't ready to, you know, put their boots on and go into an encampment, but, you know, as small as a smile at someone that's panhandling at a red light goes a long way. Instead of looking at them as, oh my gosh, they're, you know, they're choosing this. Could you spend 2 seconds with a smile and a wave? Or, you know, I keep crackers, peanut butter crackers and bus passes in my car and pass those out. So Our Calling has a wonderful little book that you can pass out that has all the resources, what shelters you can go to. I pass those out a lot. So there are things that people could do, and it does make a huge impact. Just smiling at someone makes a huge impact.
So I think we've mentioned several organizations throughout the conversation. Are there some that, like, you draw inspiration from the most?
Yes, I love Texas Housers for any kind of legislation and any housing needs. They are the one, the go-to. I love the Dallas Housing Coalition. You know, they have been fighting really hard, and I'm part of that on the bond you know, everyone needs to get out in May and vote yes for G, H, and I. Those are the three housing propositions, because it's the it will make history in Dallas if we pass this. This is the most amount of money that we've ever received for housing. I love Austin Street Shelter. I think they do such a good job. They have fabulous case managers and wonderful programs there to try to help people maneuver through the system and you know, get back on their feet. Those are just some of the many. I mean, there are a lot of really good agencies out there, but those are ones that I really cling to and love to work with. And SDEP, I can't forget them, South Dallas Employment Project. So South Dallas Employment Project is a second chance agency that helps people that were criminally justice impaired. And they are doing tremendous work. And they have about 180 organizations. So if every need that you could possibly imagine, they've got all under that same umbrella.
Well, what can our community do to help support your work?
Well, we would love for you to keep tabs on our website at fightinghomelessness.org. Excuse me. And we have outreach opportunities, fundraising opportunities, but we also just have resources, and we love to tell success stories of things that are happening within our organization and with the people that we work with. You know, like I said, voting is very important. So going to the polls and saying, no, we want more housing is very important. And, you know, reaching out to your city council and asking, what in my district could I do? You know, because all of the city council representatives, you know, have a hand in this. They've either been on or they know something about the homeless response system, and kind of seeing how you can volunteer or do your part in your community to make it a better place.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much, and can't wait to watch what happens, watch the website, and definitely be looking forward to seeing what happens in the 2025 legislation. So thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I sure do appreciate it. Thank you.
Well, I certainly learned a lot today about the root causes for homelessness that I didn't even know existed. I hope that we can all take Lisa's advice to lend a smile, get involved, and vote. To learn more about how you can help, go to fightinghomelessness.org.